Welcome to SciShow Tangents, the lightly competitive science knowledge showcase. I'm your host, Hank Green. And joining this week, as always, is science expert Sari Riley.
Hello.
And our resident everyman, Sam Schultz.
Hi, Hank.
But we also have a special guest this week. It's a science communicator who has spent 10 years making educational videos for several channels, including Soul Pancake, Seeker, and Una Dose of Trace. He's currently producing, writing, and hosting the science and supposedly comedy podcast. That's absurd. Please elaborate with his fellow nerd and good buddy, Trace Dominguez. And not that it's relevant, but lists come in threes. He once won tickets to the Grammys in a dance-off. It's Julian Huguet!
Wow.
Hi.
Hi.
You can win tickets to the Grammys?
If that's the prize in a dance-off that I happen to be at.
Was there like a music industry person involved in the dance-off?
It was an LA radio station that was having like a party pre-Grammys. Okay. Harry Styles was there. I did not meet him.
Did you beat him in the dance contest?
I wish. But I couldn't. We all know. But he may already be going to the Grammys.
Yeah.
He wouldn't need tickets. That would have been mean of him.
Yeah.
Right? Harry Styles would never do something like win tickets to a Grammys that he's already clearly invited to.
Rip the tickets up right in front of your face.
Yeah, it's like buying out all the tickets to his own concert in the front row. Like, nobody can see me.
You know, Billy Joel does that. I love this. Billy Joel does not sell the front row tickets to his shows. And then he has his staff go and give them to people in the back because he got tired of scalpers selling them for too much money. And people in the front row, because they were all Richie Rich Pants, never had any fun. And that made it less fun for him. And so Billy Joel never sells the front two rows to his shows. And it makes me love him and want to listen to Ripper of Dreams right now.
That's awesome. Has he ever forfeited a dance-off for the good of a fan? Or is that unknown?
Yeah, I think that's sort of how he spends his Tuesdays.
Saturdays, he's the piano man. Tuesdays, he's the breakdance man. Which was how I won the tickets, by the way.
You were breakdancing?
Yes.
Oh, so this wasn't like a dance as like longer than everyone's. It was dancing better than everyone else.
Yes. Wow. Yeah, it was a competition of skill.
Are you a really good dancer?
Comparatively to the other people at this event, yes.
Okay.
He was better than everyone else in the room.
I think it was the surprise. I think it's because I look like I do people's taxes in my spare time for fun. And then I can bust one, maybe two moves.
This lends more credence to the idea that Hank Green is in fact a Julian Huguet impersonator. Because I'm also a pretty good dancer, but obviously not as good as you.
My bio, I almost put the third thing is like, and often called the poor man's Hank Green, which is like 50% of the YouTube comments I get. But I didn't want to be presumptuous.
You're also better at hockey than me. I really am a Julian Huguet impersonator.
The floor is low there.
But the only sport I've ever played, and you're better at it than me, because I've seen you play hockey. Yeah,
we have to organize an actual hockey comp. I'm a goalie. Do
hockey
you
competition
out?
And dance-off.
And dance-off. Combination hockey competition dance-off.
There's zero chance that I would score on you.
You're alienating all the people who listen to this show, okay? They don't dance and they don't play hockey. I guarantee you that. Sari, Hank, real fast, tell me what's the easiest choice that you can make of all choices.
The pizza that is currently in the fridge.
Oh, baby, I love to hear that.
Easiest choice? Take a nap, always. What do I want to do? Lay? Nothing.
That's great. Hey, here's a super easy choice, just right off the top of my head. Selling with Shopify. Now, I know all about Shopify, the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, online or in person, with the internet's best converting checkout, 35% better on average compared to other leading e-commerce platforms. But Hank, why don't you tell us why you and your company, DFTBA, love Shopify so much?
We started DFTBA in 2007, and we had some non-Shopify providers early on, and switching over to Shopify was the best choice that we could have made. Now, we didn't know that when we made it, but it seemed like they knew what was going on and they were going to be around for a long time. And it turned out we were right. And now they really are the industry standard. They have a whole developer ecosystem where lots of people make products inside of their app system. And so you can always add new and cool things into your Shopify so that you can get all of the things that you need to get done for your specific business done. And I feel very kind of grateful that we picked Shopify when we did so that we have never had to switch, because switching is bad.
Wondering if you should give Shopify a try, like Hank and DFGBA are using it. Let me make that decision a little easier for you. What if all it costs to try it for a month was $1? That's right. You can sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tangents, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/tangents now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/tangents.
Every week here on SciShow Can't Tangents, we get together to try to one-up and amaze and delight each other with science facts while also trying to stay on topic. Our panelists are playing for glory and for Hank Bucks, which I will award them as we play. At the end of the episode, one of them will be crowned the winner. Now, as always, we're going to introduce this week's topic with the traditional science poem, this week from Julian.
Oh boy. This poem is titled An Ode to Telescopes, a completely original poem by Julian Huguet. Twinkle, twinkle, little star, how I wonder what you are. Why some wander in the firmament while all the rest are permanent, and how it is that each of you seem equally afar. As much as I squint and strain, points of light you all remain. With lenses ground for eyeglasses, the new use for the spyglass is to maximize your tiny size and minimize my pain. Who'd have thought it would disprove the claims of many men who have, working under an assumption, said the sky's implicit functions place Terra firmly in the center, and yet it moves. Tons of new techniques evolved, lenses' limits were resolved. Now spectra are divisible, and specters once invisible shift the size of star-filled skies, still riddles are unsolved.
Nice.
First stories remain untold, so I'll venture to the cold. I'll ride fires of discovery, roam and search the skies above me, pull out the pins and soak it in, the universe unfolds. I've gazed on Luna's lovely face, gained perspective on the human race, set off on a frontier chase and found my place in time and space. I see the stars now sprinkled through the fabric that they've wrinkled and cannot help but be amazed. It started with a twinkle.
Bro, come on.
Give me that line again. I see the with the fabric that they've wrinkled. That's what was that one. Give me that again.
I see the stars now sprinkled through the fabric that they've wrinkled.
Fabric that they've wrinkled? Damn, boy.
Yeah. If there's any Grammy competitions, like tickets for poetry slams, I'm also in it to win it too.
So the topic for the day is telescopes, which are, I think, we know what those are, right, Sari? Yes, they're just things you build to make things look closer than they are.
Yeah, you observing distant objects, and specifically by detecting electromagnetic radiation. So anywhere right. along that spectrum. And if you stick the telescope in like a vehicle or a building, that's an observatory. So you right. can have them on the ground, you can have them in planes or balloons, or you can have just like a space telescope that's free floating around. And then there are lots of different types of telescopes that Julian kind of covered poetically, and I will cover not poetically. The first ones were optical telescopes. So basically taking things that we can see with our eyes in the visible part of the electromagnetic spectrum and making them zoomed in, like looking mm-hmm. at far away things closer. We made refracting telescopes out of lenses, and the first telescopes were made by people who were already working in the lens sphere on eyeglasses, and then those became spy glasses. And then we were like, what about mirrors? What if we used mirrors instead of just like glass lenses to reflect light? So we made reflecting mm-hmm. telescopes, and then we combined mirrors and lenses. We were like, what if we mess optically with both of them? And then from there, we were like, there are other wavelengths in the electromagnetic spectrum. So what if we created devices that detect outside of this very narrow range of visible light, and started going to like radio waves and gamma rays and microwaves and all those things.
And so you end up with telescopes that do not look like telescopes. They just look like giant satellite dishes. Mm-hmm. And you're like, this yeah. can't be a telescope. But yeah. what I'm hearing is that a gravitational wave detector, not a telescope.
Yeah, those the gravitational wave detectors like LIGO, right, is a laser interferometer. And so it uses like laser beams that are at 90 degrees to each other and that, you know, shoot down a really, really long tunnel and then come back. But then as the Earth kind of, I think the scientific term is jiggles, as it gets all jiggled. Mm-hmm.
We like to say Wiggles, but Jingles is okay too.
Oh, well, see, Wiggles is in two dimensions, but Jiggles is in three dimensions.
Oh, no. Oh, okay.
So
Juggalos are in four dimensions.
Juggles, I don't know how they work. They're in another whole other plane. But yeah, they detect how the laser interferes with itself. And so they can measure how much wiggling is happening.
Of space-time, which is not... So like, that's a wave in space-time, not in the electromagnetic field or whatever, however photons work.
Exactly.
So technically a telescope. I do have several questions for Sari.
I can try my best.
Are binoculars a telescope?
I think... Yes. They're just two telescopes next to each other. You're doing both eyes. If a spyglass is a telescope, binocular, just two spyglasses together. You could rip them apart if you were strong enough.
My iPhone has a 3x magnification camera. Do I have a very small telescope in it?
Is a camera a telescope?
I think so.
Yeah, I mean, like the Hubble and Webb don't have like a person looking through it. They are just big cameras.
I think so. And like a lot of early telescopes. So after we went from looking with our eyes and before the time where we could beam data into screens, a lot of telescopes just did photography, like a giant camera lens. Mm-hmm. So...
I would also say a telescope doesn't have to be a single instrument either, right? Because now we're using multiple like dishes positioned around the world to act as one enormous telescope, right? And to see resolve images like in that method, but like the instruments themselves are like distantly separated.
Right.
So... You know, you got to expand your mind on what a telescope can be.
I think that gravitational lenses are telescopes, even though we didn't build them. They're just natural telescopes.
Put a pin in that thought.
Yeah,
we'll get to that later.
Stop talking about that, Hank.
Yeah, don't bring that up. Don't bring that up yet for no reason. Not saying nothing, not for nothing, but don't think about that.
And Sari, I feel like telescope, the word, that's got to be a new one. And it's not complicated.
Yeah, it's relatively new. It's the thing about these kind of words is that old scientists would write a bunch of letters to each other. And so we have a lot of physical documentation of this is probably the first time it was written. And then it was probably spoken around that time, too. So the first letter where we saw the word, the Italian word telescopio.
Ooh. Love that.
Very good Italian pronunciation.
Telescopio. I don't know. went from Federico Chessi to Galileo. And Chessi was the founder and first president of like an Academy of Sciences in Italy. But Chessi was familiar with the work of the Greek mathematician Giovanni Demisiani. And so it's possible that Demisiani was the first to suggest the name telescopium for the instrument. And then Chessi just like wrote about it and was very excited. But before we got that word, before we landed on it, Galileo had used perspicillium and Kepler had used perspicillium and conspicillium from which meant through, and specchio, like spectacles, which means to observe or watch or look at, which. I'm glad
periscope
we didn't land on that.
Is basically
those are nasty. I don't like those at all.
Perspicillium.
It sounds like a disease you get in a swimming pool.
Yeah. Or a medical instrument or some kind.
It does sound like something that you put inside of a person.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally. Gaze into the abyss in a different way.
My toe got perspicillium. They had to take it right off.
I can't eat for 24 hours. I have a perspicillium appointment.
Yeah. But we landed on telescope, which just means like tele is like far, like a telephoto lens, and scope, which means to look or see.
All right. Let's move on to the part of our show where we play a game. We got a quiz, and I'm going to quiz you guys. It's going to be an episode of Truth or Fail. So telescopes, obviously fantastic tools for far seeing into the cosmos, but it turns out that telescopes are also excellent tools for studying things a little closer to the Earth. The following are three stories of earthly uses of telescopes, but only one of them is true. Which one is it? A previously known herd of llamas was discovered in a previously unknown.
Okay, there we go. Oh, those llamas? Yeah, I know them.
We forgot.
Nothing new there.
We redescovered
that herd of llamas in there.
That's where
I found those guys weeks ago.
I lost my llamas.
They were known and then unknown and then known again. No. A previously unknown herd of llamas was discovered in the Atacama Desert in Chile because movements were causing small deviations in the typical measurements taken by a telescope at the Paranal Observatory. Or it could be story number two. Scientists adapted an algorithm normally used to calibrate the focus on telescopes into a tool that can characterize the density and thickness of clouds so that they can more accurately predict the weather. Or it also could be story number three. To uncover landmines, scientists developed a system where they used telescopes to monitor the locations of bees that were specifically trained to sniff out mines. So it could be number one, discovering a llama herd, an unknown one, with telescope measurements. Story number two, predicting the weather with telescopes. Or story number three, tracking landmine detecting bees.
Okay. The thing about the new herd of llamas is, are they like a known species of llama? And then it's like, there's a herd.
No, they were a known species. So like, they existed, not like a whole new llama.
Well, who cares?
Yeah, they're just some llamas in the place where you find llamas.
First of all, people care. And it's nice to find a new herd of llamas. Second, it's weird that they did it with a telescope.
Well, if it was like llamas were found like, in Hawaii near the Mauna Kea Observatory, that would be really surprising.
Oh, wow. We missed the llamas on this barren volcanic plain.
How did you get here, llama?
They're the size of grains of rice, so they were very easy to miss.
Jeez. Okay. I just don't think it would make news, you know?
Yeah. No one would write a paper about that, and no one would find the paper where somebody wrote about it.
I hear that.
And it's too dry for llamas to be out in the desert, in the Atacama Desert, I bet.
Quite dry up there because it's so hot, high up, right?
They're like the camels of South America.
The smallest organisms that are that high up, though, are just like bacteria. No, not even that. Like, they can't survive, right?
They found that alien there, too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I did forget about the alien. Yeah.
Did I not mention they were alien llamas?
Okay. The cloud one just seems like if this isn't real, then like Deboki just like invented something probably that, you know, she's going to be rich now.
Sure.
Yeah, I feel cloud makes sense. I'm trying to figure out the logistics of the bee tracking telescope. Like, where would my telescope be? Yeah. Where would my bee be? I just can't picture it. I'm going to pick clouds.
Are they like the satellites that are like the Google Map satellites? Are those telescopes that are pointed at Earth? Mm-hmm. I feel like the bee one is so similar to like other explosive sniffing bee stories that it seems like maybe it's an amalgam. So I'm going to go with the clouds as well. Sari?
I mean,
you're going to know something that's going to blow the lid off of this, I bet.
You know, you poo-pooed. You both poo-pooed on the llamas. I love these known llamas, these previously unknown, then known llamas. And so I'm going to pick that one.
We have, for the first time in a while, no winners.
Oh no, the bees! The bees!
In 2005, scientists here in my home state of Montana published a paper describing their system that combined the incredible odor tracking abilities of bees with a fascinating world of telescopes. To train the bees, you feed them a syrup mixed with a chemical that you would like them to seek out. In this case, they used a byproduct of TNT synthesis, and that caused the bees to associate that smell with food. To track the bees, the scientists used a system called LIDAR, which is sort of like radar, except it uses light instead of radio waves. And the scientists used a laser to scan the field, and as the bees flew around the area, the light from the laser would scatter and be received by a telescope. Studying that light scattering gave the scientists information about where the bees were located, which in turn allowed them to figure out where the mines in their experimental facility were. I'm not sure if telescopes that track mind-detecting bees have yet become a widespread technology that had been implemented in the field, but other scientists have adopted this technique to study insect populations in different areas.
Damn.
So it's a real thing, telescope bee tracking.
Wow.
And I get it, because like I was kind of picturing like a telescope like zooming in and tracking an individual bee.
But it was sort of LIDAR with telescope tracking.
Forgive the pun, but that had every science buzzword.
Yeah, right?
Well, zeros all around. Dang it. Wait, was so there the points any... don't matter. Hank, why did I send you my bank account information then?
You know what? You're actually the second, you're the second guest who's mentioned that, which is a little suspicious at this point.
I don't do anything with it. I just like to have other people's bank accounts. It's just sort of like a collection that I have.
He just thinks they're neat.
It's a nice to have.
So there was some, a little bit of nuggets here. In 2019, an earthquake in Chile did cause telescopes to shake, which in turn meant that the satellites, some of them were watching, became streaks in the images instead of their usual static dots. And scientists are trying to see if they can use telescopes to study changes in the planet's crust, particularly using a technique called very long baseline interferometry, which combines light gathered by multiple telescopes around the world to effectively build a larger telescope, as Julian was talking about earlier. By measuring the timestamps of observations at different telescopes in different locations, scientists can calculate distance very precisely and combine that with other techniques to better understand what's happening along the Earth's surface.
What was up with the llama thing then?
Oh, nothing.
Okay.
just that we could use telescopes to like learn things that we wouldn't expect to be able to learn, I think.
Sure.
That's what I'm going for.
Everything's got to be based on something. What? Come on, have a little wonder.
Have a little wonder.
And the Hubble Space Telescope does have an algorithm to match stars, and that was converted into a tool that can identify the spots on individual whale sharks so that people can catalog and track whale sharks. So that is a real thing, and we could have used
really
that
cool.
as a fact, but we
That's
didn't.
Super cool.
It's also been used to track other sharks and fish that have spotty skin.
Why spotty skin, specifically?
Because
just it
stars,
looks like stars
are like spots.
Oh,
yeah.
It's good at spots. Oh, I love that for Hubble. Cool. He's very good at one thing, and that's finding spots.
That's such a so condescending.
Yeah.
That's cool.
All right, next we're going to take a short break. Then we'll be back for the Fact Off.
SciShow Tangents is brought to you by Rocket Money, a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Money is annoying. You have to remember so much stuff, like your bank account password and your PIN number. You got to balance your checkbook, and I don't even know what that means to balance your checkbook. You got to put all your receipts in a folder or something probably too. And who has time for all that? Not me, the old money dummy himself. But if you don't manage your finances, there can be dire consequences. Like maybe, for instance, you pay your utility bill twice. Huh?
You know, we all make mistakes. We all move sometimes. My partner and I moved recently. I didn't think to check the old utility accounts, but then I was doing my taxes and going through all the utility bills. And we logged into our old account and I was like, what the heck? There's a couple $100 bill here for an apartment that we don't live in anymore. Mm. What's going on here?
The electric company's just like, thank you very much.
Yeah. And I was just too busy and too tired to figure out that out until mid-February when I was like, oh, shoot. But boy, would it have been easier if we had an app that said, you're paying your utility bill twice.
The unfortunate truth of the matter is it's important to keep on top of your finances. But the fortunate truth is that Rocket Money exists. Rocket Money gives you a clear view of your expenses, letting you see your spending in one place at a glance. Rocket Money gives you the power to easily track your monthly spending, create custom budgets, and even find and cancel unwanted subscription services and also potentially utility bills for old apartments you don't live in anymore. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when you use all the app's features.
Stop wasting money on things you don't use, like subscription services, and stop paying your power bill twice, like I almost did. Thankfully didn't. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions and manage your finances the easy way by going to rocketmoney.com/tangents. That's rocketmoney.com/tangents. rocketmoney.com/TANGENTS.
Hello, everybody. Now, get ready for the Factor. Our panelists have brought science facts to present to me in an attempt to blow my mind. And after they've presented their facts, I will judge them and award Hank Bucks any way I see fit. And because we have a 0-0-0 tie right now, the best fact's going to win this one, you guys. But to decide who goes first, I have a trivia question. When the James Webb Space Telescope was ready for launch, there were, of course, practical considerations, like how to transport the telescope from California to its launch site in French Guiana. One important component of the plan was a container that held much of the telescope called the Space Telescope Transporter for Air, Road, and Sea, or STARS, which was about 18 feet high and 16 feet wide. But how long was STARS?
I mean, it's probably a train, right? Held much of the telescope.
I think the air bit's important, because how big can you make a container that still fits in an airplane? I wish I knew the internal volume of a C-130 Hercules, but I just don't.
You just said a lot of words. I'm going to guess 100 feet. I'm just trying to think what's long, but not too long. 100 feet?
I'm going to say that's too long.
Okay.
I'm going to go 99 just to do Price is Right and be the worst person that there is.
Yeah, he's playing to win, you guys. Sarah, you said 100 and Julian said 99?
I said 100 feet, yes.
99.
It was 110 feet long.
Son of a...
I don't know, big planes. But I know big numbers.
I don't know if it actually ever did travel by air. I don't
Needed to get that acronym. They needed to be STARS, yeah. And they had to figure out a way to make it that.
Everything does travel through the air, you know?
That's a good one. Yeah.
We're just being pedantic. There's no
According to Hank's research, at one point, the telescope was transported in STARS via C-5 Charlie, the largest transport aircraft in the U.S. military fleet. So there you go.
And it also had to be moved on a cargo ship, and it traveled at 5 to 10 miles an hour to keep a smooth ride. Never went faster than that until they put it in a frickin' spaceship and launched it into space. Wow. We need to have a really smooth ride, but we are going to put you on top of a bomb. Very slow bomb. All right. So, Sari, that means you get to go first.
So one of the big challenges of using an optical telescope here on Earth's surface to look up at space is that there's all this atmosphere in the way. And the gases in air refract visible light in lots of different ways that we can see with our eyes. That shimmer or haze when you look at hot air, the blue color of a clear sky or the oranges of a sunset, or even the twinkling of stars. And we have a whole song and now an ode about that last one. There's probably songs about sunsets and blue skies too. But, you know, all of those things.
We don't have time to check.
What do I know? So astronomers weren't satisfied with blurriness when studying or imaging faraway objects. And in 1953, the American astronomer Dr. Horace W. Babcock published a paper that explained a way to correct that blurriness by measuring the distortion of light around one bright star in the area of the sky that you're interested in, and then tweaking the mirrors in the telescope. At this time, they were using reflecting telescopes a lot, to correct the image, which laid the foundation of this idea called adaptive optics. And you can't just pick any star if you want to do adaptive optics. They really targeted these so-called natural guide stars, which have to be bright enough in the sky to have enough information to do these calculations and adjustments. Mm-hmm. So the idea could have died there. But instead, we decided to make fake stars with laser beams so that we could do adaptive optics on our telescopes. And one of the most prominent artificial star laser systems nowadays was fully installed in 2016 at the ESO's Parnell Observatory in Chile, which we already talked about, which is where they keep their very large telescope, which is its official name. And this four laser guide star facility contains 22 watt beams that are attuned to around 589 nanometers. So specifically, those photons energize electrons in sodium atoms that are hanging around in the Earth's atmosphere at around 90 kilometers above the surface in the mesosphere. The sodium atoms that are floating around re-emit those photons, which are the artificial starlight that can be detected by the telescope and used in these sort of adaptive optics calculations. This is the exact same principle in sodium vapor streetlights, which are quite bright here on the surface. But because they're so high up and have all this atmospheric distortion, these artificial stars are around 20 times fainter than the faintest star we can see with just our human eyes. So we can't actually look up and see artificial stars in the sky, but they are bright enough for a telescope to see and mathematically compensate for the atmosphere and get super sharp images of stars and space objects.
Why are there sodium atoms in the atmosphere?
That I don't know.
It's got to be like 0.00000001% of the atmosphere. Like sodium. It's not like, what does it do? Like, I guess just from the salt water?
Yeah, that would make sense, right? Like if it's dissociated in salt water. And then, it just gets kicked up, right? Like how we find like microorganisms like on the outside of the ISS, because like sometimes stuff just gets carried away.
From what I can tell from a quick search, it is like seawater and terrestrial sodium, but also possibly from like meteors, but like a natural layer. They're called the metallic vapor layers of our atmospheres.
Neat. And so the laser hits them and makes them glow a little bit. And then it's a little fake star for us to look at. And we know exactly what it's like.
We use it, to adjust the telescope so we can look at real stars and make the pictures even better.
That's so cool.
Yeah. It would be fun to try and make a list of like the smartest ideas.
Totally unbiased.
Top 10 smartest things that a person ever did.
Yeah.
According to us.
Yeah. Okay. You could have sponsored segments be like, buying gold was the smartest thing.
All right, Julian. Tall order, but it's your turn.
So, Hank, I don't know if you've ever heard of this phenomenon. It's called gravitational lensing.
I have.
I'm going to tell you about it and hopefully change your perspective on the universe a little bit in a literal sense. Okay. So we're going to start with just telescopes. I feel like, you'd think, it's obvious, but like they might not be so obvious, right? But the idea is you take a bunch of light from a source, right? Because the source is emitting light in all directions and it's spreading out, but only so much of it actually hits your eye and gets focused on the back of your retina and you actually see that. So you take some of that light that's going not towards your eye and you bend it, you change it, you bring it back towards your eye, you bounce it into your eye, and then you see more of light from that thing. So that thing's brighter or bigger, easier to see. So this was the idea behind the optical telescopes that Galileo came up with. The lens of his telescope was about 38 millimeters, so roughly an inch and a half. Then they started building bigger lenses, but an issue with glass lenses the light passes through is that the wavelengths of light don't bend the same amount because they have different amounts of energy. So as you send this through a glass, you're going to get basically a spectrum effect or a prism effect.
Right.
So you have what's called chromatic aberration as a result, where the colors have different focal points. So there's a limit to how big these glass lenses can get before you start distorting what it actually looks like. So Isaac Newton came up with this idea of using mirrors instead. And as they got bigger and better, they also corrected chromatic aberration with new glass lenses. And so they still reach a point where with a lens or a reflector, they can only get so big for a single instrument. So the very large telescope, as Sari was talking about, it's made up of four smaller telescopes. The primary mirrors on those are 8.2 meters each. So large, like 25 feet or so, but still that we can go bigger, right? So next to the very large telescope, they're building the extremely large telescope. It's planned for 2027. I guess they're not great at names, but anyway.
Oh, it's good. I like it. I'm not going to forget.
Let's say it how it is.
Yeah. That mirror is going to be made up of almost 800 segments. It's going to be 39.3 meters in diameter. So pretty sure bigger than that star container that James Webb was shipped in. Mm-hmm. Quite large. But still, we're coming up against the limits of what you can do with a single instrument or optic. So we have to think bigger. Much bigger. Stellar sized bigger.
Very big.
Quite large. Because Einstein, another name that you may be familiar with, he came up with that whole general relativity idea. that says that things with mass bend space and time, and so it bends the path that light travels on. Well, what does a telescope do? Bends the path of light.
Bends light.
So people realized, Einstein realized, and he predicted that you could use the gravitational warping of space-time as a lens. And this was confirmed in 1919 when scientists took expeditions to go see a solar eclipse. They had to sail down to an island off the coast of west coast of Africa. It was Arthur Eddington. And he watched this eclipse happen and noticed that stars that they know the position of, you know, normally when they observe it in other parts of the year, they seem to be farther away from the sun than they typically were because the light coming from them was bent. So this confirms this idea that you can use gravity to focus light. And so we've taken that idea and we've applied it to galaxies, galaxy clusters, even stars within our own galaxy. And using that, we can actually focus the light from some of the earliest galaxies that existed. This is how the Hubble Space Telescope actually sees far back to the beginning of the universe. It takes light from these very, very faint ancient galaxies and uses known gravitational lenses to bend them and bring them together. So we are planning in the future to send up the Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope, and it's going to observe the center of the Milky Way, looking for exoplanets using this gravitational lensing technique. And that's all very cool. But here's the mind-blowing fact that I wanted to get to eventually. And that is, there was a 2022 study that used machine learning to try and identify gravitational lens candidates. And there's not very many that we've identified before. There's about 100 that we typically go to look at because it's kind of hard to tell when the image you're looking at is maybe separate galaxies or if it's like some weird warping effect from a gravitational lens. So they picked out 5,000 potential gravitational lenses using this algorithm. They checked how accurate the algorithm was by hand, looking at 77 of these candidates, and 88% of them were gravitational lenses. And to be clear, the lenses aren't like lenses that we made that are supposed to be all perfect and resolve an image. They act more like a funhouse mirror that, you know, warp things and distort them. What this means, though, ultimately, is that there are way more gravitational lenses than we realized and have found. So when you're standing here on Earth and you're looking up at that night sky, along with the atmospheric interference and the twinkling, you've got a lot of gravitational warping affecting the very, very distant light that's coming to you. So essentially, you're always peering out into a funhouse, distorted, warped misrepresentation of the universe every time you gaze into the night sky.
I don't mind that the universe had a beginning, but I don't like that you like look back at time. That freaks me out. That disturbs me. That we could like see the first light.
It's like the most extreme version of like the internet never forgets kind of thing. It's like, you know, you go far back enough and somebody can watch everything you did.
Yeah. Like there's an alien looking at me, you know.
Yeah.
That's why I stay inside all the time. You can't see me if I'm inside, aliens. The light's not getting out of here.
We'll have pictures of all of our butts from every year we were alive. And then
yeah, I've been sending those and they haven't responded yet. I'm kind of mad.
You're keeping them away.
What's it going to take, aliens?
So I'm fighting between a fact that was more new to me and a fact that is more mind-bending, literally universe-bending. I think that I'll give it to Julian because it is the weirder, wilder fact.
I'm going to split it with Sari because I think that Sari's fact was super cool and I would like to have joint custody of these Hank bucks.
Yes,
because that was a great one.
And it comes along with a free ticket to the Webbies.
Wow, I didn't even have to dance.
All right, now it's time to ask the Science Couch where we get a listener question for our couch of finely honed scientific minds.
Janor and Faye713 on Discord asked, what is the least optical-based telescope / how did we start building telescopes that can receive and translate light outside of the human perception?
That's interesting. So like optical meaning visible light, I guess, is how to interpret this. So we've talked about this a little bit, but like, there's a very wide spectrum of electromagnetic radiation. and you hear radiation and you think that's strange and it's from another, that's like esoteric weird stuff. But a slice of it is visible light, is electromagnetic radiation. Mm-hmm. So is like the stuff in x-rays that you have to worry about giving you cancer. And so is like gamma rays that if they hit you, they could kill you. If there's a lot of them, there's a very small density that
there's the right amount turn you into the Hulk. Right,
that's what I was gonna say.
Hard to find, but it's out there.
So the question for me is like, at what point did we notice that there's more of this stuff, and it is the same stuff,
yeah,
but there's more of it than we could see. And freaky. Did we know, like, when did we realize that it was all the same stuff? For me, the least optical-based telescope, all telescopes are optical, but I guess the least, like, furthest from the visible light spectrum, I guess, is an interesting question. Like, Webb would be on the edge one way, and a couple of other infrared telescopes, but I think Webb is the furthest over infrared telescope. And in the other direction, I don't know. But now I've realized that, in fact, it does go way beyond infrared.
It does go beyond. But that is the direction that I took it of, like,
okay,
what is... So, I think we've been science communicating with each other for long enough that I also took it to the place of when was the point in time where we realized that we could make telescopes that detect things mm-hmm. other than... light, like what we moved see. Beyond spy glasses, and both these answers converged into radio telescopes, which are way like really, really long wavelengths. So the radio waves are the things that work in to like play the radio. Those are the wavelengths that gets transmitted across the world, and those feel like pretty non-optical to me. Even though they are light, they are weird light, and we associate it with hearing because we have devices, the radio transceivers, I think that's the right word, that transmit radio waves that change that into vibrations that are the sound that we come to our ear. And radio astronomy was kind of an accident, like a happy accident. So the first transatlantic phone call was made in around 1927. Before we had phone cables. And so telecommunications were carried by radio waves, just like radio communications. And so Bell Telephone Laboratories, hired a physicist to be like, our telephone across the Atlantic Ocean is getting kind of staticky. Can you mm-hmm. figure that out? You know physics. And this physicist's name was Carl Guth-Jansky. And so he built a big array of antennas that is like the size of a small house. If you look up pictures of it, it's like a bigger than a bus, smaller than like a huge house, but like chunky. And it did a complete rotation once every 20 minutes. It was like this huge box of antennas. He put it in a potato field in an abandoned potato farm. He just like detected radio waves for a couple of years. He found some radio static coming from nearby thunderstorms or like distant storms, but he found this mystery static too. A strange radio hiss at a wavelength of about 14.6 meters. And he tuned into this hiss, he tracked it, and this was like before microwaves or cell phones, so like there wasn't radio static from that, but he pulled out a star chart and realized that the hiss was wherever the Sagittarius constellation was in the sky around the Earth.
That's so cool.
Another candidate for smartest thing ever.
For smart. Yeah. And the sad thing is he like continued to think about star noise and like presented thoughts and wrote papers, but Bell Labs was like, oh, we figured it, like, let's put you on telephone projects now. Like, we don't care about space. You found space radio waves? That, whatever. We're doing telephones here on Earth. We're not talking to aliens. Mm-hmm. And so other folks, like Grote Reber, I'm not pronouncing his name right, built a radio telescope in his backyard based on this research, and people started looking into radio astronomy after this telephone guy accidentally discovered it. And that's just wild to me. Like, it is, like, we stumbled upon non-optical astronomy. Or not, like outside of the visible light range astronomy.
And then we told the guy who did it to shut up.
And we told him to stop.
Yeah.
Yeah, work on the telephones.
That's, and there's no profit in that. Get back to work. Yeah.
Yeah. And just this idea of like radio waves. I think we associate them with audio, and like radio astronomy is where we get like the sounds of pulsars or the energy from a neutron star. Scientists don't listen to them to understand the data. Like, that's not the valuable information, but I think it's a fun science communication tool to be able to like listen to the aurora of Jupiter and have this noise, because we have the technology already to convert radio waves into something like sound that we can listen to. And so it feels far from optics in some way.
Well, that's pretty cool.
A lot of Bell Labs accidental discoveries, right? Because weren't like physicists working for Bell Labs the two guys who found the cosmic microwave background radiation?
Yeah,
if memory serves.
Also then.
Yeah, it was whose names I don't recall, but
then they shoved him in the locker. They said, "Does this help us with phones?" I don't think so. Get out of here, nerd.
If you want to ask the Science Couch your questions, you can follow us on Twitter at @SciShowTangents, where we'll tweet out topics for upcoming episodes every week, or you can join our Patreon and ask us on our Discord. Thanks to @Suzanne5803 on YouTube and @MayaByard. Or B Yard on Twitter. And everybody else also who asked us your questions for this episode. Julian, where can we listen to your voice or watch your content?
Wow, what a great tee up. I have a podcast with a good friend who you know. He was an early guest on SciShow Tangents, Trace Dominguez. It's called That's Absurd, Please Elaborate. Available wherever fine podcasts are posted. You'll also find us. So if you like science, and then like tangents that shoot off of whatever the topic is that you're talking about, our
show, wait a minute.
It might be a good fit for you. Oh, wait, yeah.
I think we're going to have someone look into this.
Oh, no. Oh, I've opened myself up to litigation.
That's right. That's what's going to happen. If you like this show and you want to help us out, there's a couple ways you could do that. First, you can go to patreon.com/scishowtangents to become a patron and get access to our newsletter and our bonus episodes, and got a special shout out to our patron, Les Aker, for their support. Second, you can leave us a review wherever you listen. That helps us know what you like about the show. And finally, if you want to show your love for SciShow Tangents, just
tell people about us.
Thanks for joining us. I've been Hank Green.
I've been Sari Riley.
I've been Sam Schultz.
I'm Julian Huguet.
SciShow Tangents is created by all of us and produced by Jess Stempert. Our associate producer is Eve Schmidt. Our editor is Seth Glicksman. Our story editor is Alex Billow. Our social media organizer is Julia Buzz Bazzio. Our editorial assistant is Deboki Chakravarti. Our sound design is by Joseph Junamedish. Our executive producers are Nicole Sweet and me, Hank Green. And of course, we couldn't make any of this without our patrons on Patreon. Thank you, and remember, the mind is not a vessel to be filled, but a fire to be lighted.
But one more thing. In November 2004, NASA launched the Neil Gehrels Swift Observatory into low Earth orbit with three telescopes aboard. One of them is called the Burst Alert Telescope, or BAT for short, which collects data about gamma ray bursts. This mission is still going strong, and in a September 2020 paper, a team of astrophysicists introduced the Gamma Ray Urgent Archiver for Novel Opportunities, or GUANO for short, which helps recover what they described as data dumps from BAT. Less funny words, GUANO is a computer program. Yeah, you get it now.
That's good.
In less funny words, GUANO is a computer program that communicates with instruments that detect things like fast radio bursts or gravitational waves, and then it cues BAT to look for super faint gamma ray bursts in the same regions of space. So, Burst Alert Telescope and Gamma Ray Urgent Archiver of Novel Opportunities, or BAT, and GUANO.
Usually, that's not usually how they do it, but I like that they did it that way that time.
I'm working right now with some community college students on like a NASA thing, and like I was pitching acronyms, and they came up with like soup with two S's and lamb, and I was like, I think you kids have got the idea. Yes,
you're there.
They're gonna nailed go it. Pretty far.
Mm-hmm.